The podcast you are about to listen to discusses comic books and comic book related media. Be warned, the following will review art, plot, and themes, and will therefore contain spoilers of the materials discussed. Welcome to Comics League International.
To our podcast, this is Brent and Lydia. I'm Lydia, presents Starman.
Yay!
Insert cheering.
Okay. Huzzah!
Huzzah! Oh, no, cheering, I promise, not random birds.
There are birds, though, somewhere.
They're hiding. I'll be honest, it's a little late in the day. They're still in their hidey hole, because once I get them out, they're going to want to be played with. And so they'll just, you know,
yeah,
they're
going
to have to wait for about the hour. And then I'll play with them a lot.
Okay. Good for you. I don't have any pets. I want a turtle, but I heard that you have to plan for your death because they all outlive you.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. No, anyway.
And they get huge. They get really, really big.
Yeah, I know. I do want turtle. They're really smelly, though. Okay, this is the 12th episode of Brent and Lydia Talk Starman. And it's issue 11?
Yes.
Issue 11, right? And it came out in September 1995.
Ooh.
So what? It's 2016, so mm-hmm. It's 21 years? Really? This is 21 years old?
Yes.
Comic?
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, wow, okay. It's just hit me. I've never counted, like, how old... It never occurred to me how old Starman is.
I really don't like to do the math on on how old things from the 90s are. Because, you know, I mean, I'm 35 this year, and I'm completely okay with being 35. It's actually quite fun. But then when I look at stuff that came out when I was in high school and realize that was, you know, two decades ago, that's when it's like, ooh.
Right.
Somehow realizing what actually being 35 means, that's where I just... Time feels funny.
Yeah, I know. But it helps to, like, continue keeping up with the times and, you know, being on YouTube and finding out what the young ones are into recently. So that helps, but it's like there is also a shared nostalgia, you know, when you realize a lot of kids are still watching the things that you watched because of syndication.
Yeah. But then on the other side, sometimes you have the opposite where you'll bring up something that you think other people like should know, and they just give you blank stares.
Huh?
And you realize, wow, everyone I'm talking to right now is, especially if it's like music, you know, like you bring up, like, hey, remember the Squirrel Nut Zippers and how they were really, really popular for like 6 months? And then you're looking at everyone who's, you know, just younger than you to be like, we have no idea what you're talking about at all.
Right. Yeah. I know the feeling. I mean, I'm 28, but it's it's not. It's like, I live in another country, and, you know, with the cultural differences, with the friends that I hang out with, sometimes it's, we are not on the same page.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that happens to me too. Speaking of times and dates and setting things up, do you happen to know anything about what was going on in September of 95?
I do, but it's not, I don't know, again, it's one of those things that I've chosen because I remember them, or they pertain to my life.
Ooh.
So I'm going to first talk about the Hindu milk miracle. Have you heard of it?
The Hindu milk miracle?
Yes. That's exactly what I said. This was in 1995 of September. It was really interesting reading about it on the internet, because I remember watching news coverage of it. In Singapore, where I come from, there are a lot of Hindus, you know, followers of Hinduism, for those of you who don't know. There is a huge Hindu population in Singapore, and that's why it was huge news back home as well. Basically, in India, at a temple, I think, there were statues of the god Ganesh. He is the god of wisdom and learning, and I think Shiva, his father, the destroyer, and I think one more god. Their statues were drinking milk. Do you remember this at all?
I don't think I heard any of this.
Okay. Because, well, it was huge for me because, you know, I had a lot of Hindu friends, and it was all over the news, and, you know, even though it happened in India, but the Hindu communities in Asia, they were really excited about this because they were saying how God had come, their God had come to visit them, and there were video clips of it on the news. We're talking about like primetime news, where you would see the statues absorbing the milk that the followers offered them. Like, it was, I saw the video clip with my own 7-year-old eyes, so it was really, it left such an impact that like 21 years later I still remember it. But some scientists, they've managed to explain it, saying it's something to do with capillary absorption, which I don't really know what it means, but I'm just guessing that because they saw the milk appear at the bottom of the statue later, so it must have been some of the, you know, physics and stuff like that. Yeah, so that was very, very interesting. It was one of those moments where you know, the mystical and the religious and reality all blended together, and it appeared on the primetime news. Yeah.
Awesome.
So, yeah, and talking about physics, the second thing that I want to talk about that happened in 1995 was Stephen Hawking. He married. There were a few like weddings of interest in September 1995. Charlie Sheen, he married a model or something, but I'm more interested in Stephen Hawking because he, you know, being a Christian and being a spouse of a physicist and being a fan of the Big Bang Theory makes me very, in a way, connected to Stephen Hawking for various reasons, because, you know, Stephen Hawking talks about the existence of God sometimes, and that's why, you know, that part of my identity is always somehow entwined with his postulate. And for him also, was it a couple of years ago, or just last year, there was a movie called The Theory of Everything?
Yeah, it was a year or two ago. It was recent.
Yeah, it was recent, and I didn't watch it, but I was like, oh, okay, there's a movie about Stephen Hawking, but he's like, I know this, in 1995, it was his second marriage, and both his marriages ended in divorce. And I was like, oh, okay, because, yeah, I don't know, for someone as enigmatic as Stephen Hawking, it just seems so normal for him to have these, I don't know, setbacks. I don't know whether you'll call it a setback, but yeah, his life is so interesting to me. It's like, you know how when you make it into a movie, you realize that Shakespeare really got it right. It's like all the worlds are stage and the melody players, because it's so, you know, and being a writer of fiction, sometimes you write it and then you're like, you know, does this work? Do people actually suspend their belief enough for them to be reading this and not be thinking, oh, this is utter crap? You know, even if it's fiction, I still feel like I doubt myself.
What I like about, like, kind of the real stories, especially in real story adaptations, is every now and then you see interviews or things where they kind of talk about, like, this is what really happened and this is how it really worked. And yet sometimes, like, this, the real story is even more just bizarre or just unbelievable. Yeah. But yeah, for the actual movie, for the adaptation, we changed it to make it less coincidental, or we changed it to kind of pull it in, because we know if we put what, like, actually happened, it would be just too out there.
Yeah, I know. I mean, for those of you who don't, I'm just going to wrap up this part really fast. Stephen Hawking, he married young, and then he got diagnosed with ALS, and then he had three kids, and then he wanted to provide for his wife's after he died, so he let the man whom his wife had an affair with stay at their apartment, and it was like, and that's how his first marriage broke up. And then he married his nurse, and then that's the wedding of interest in 1995. So yes, exactly what Brent said, it would be too out there if you know, non-fiction was actually fiction. Yeah, but we're talking about fiction, real fiction, like super science fiction, and there's a comfort in that. There's a, like, it's you just, like, go ahead and suspend your belief, go forth and suspend, and yeah. So, Starman, issue 11. Brent is going to do the synopsis for us today.
Yes, and right? it's gonna be a pretty short synopsis. Because it's. Oh, it's a quick issue. This is one of the quicker issues.
It is. Yeah, I was like, oh, wait, what?
Yeah. So the synopsis is, you know, this, it's a tale of times past. In fact, the title, 13 years ago, five friends, a tale of time past. It's the story of Ragdoll, who was the former low rank villain and who's now a cult leader. Now, the interesting about this story is this is, in a way, the second time we've been told this story. It was only an issue or two ago where Ted and Jack were talking, and Ted already told Jack a little bit of this, and here we're actually seeing it happen. Excuse me. Ragdoll, who was kind of a perpetual failure as a criminal, but as he got older and got more brittle, he actually found he was more charismatic than they would have thought, and he starts becoming essentially a cult leader, very much a more successful Charlie Manson type. And he and his troops are carrying out a crime wave across Opal City that the police and its defender, Starman, are unable to take care of. So, as these crimes go farther, and when Ragdoll engineers three different crimes to be kind of happening on the same night, Ted, he calls in four of his buddies from the Justice Society of America, even though I don't think they actually use that phrase in here, they fight the good fight. And those five heroes split into three different groups based on their different skill sets. And, well, to cut things short, in the end, they save the day, even if they do come out a little bit more scarred and a little bit more disheartened about the times.
Right, right.
And that would be how I'd sum up this issue.
Nice. I really, it's a difficult issue to summarize, I think, because it's so, it's basically the entire thing is a flashback.
Yes.
So, yes. Good job. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Shall we look at the cover?
Yes. It is creepy.
Really? Oh, yeah. Ragdoll at the bottom with the bloody hands really adds a creepiness to it.
Yeah. I mean, it's at first glance, it's very bright and shiny, but then it's creepy for me because it's Ragdoll. You don't see this Ragdoll in the comic. This version, this scary one.
Yeah.
He's more like clownish inside. But over here, he looks like, I don't know, bloodied hands and stuff. But one thing I realized is the shade is on this cover. The shade he is huge. He is given a very prominent position. It's him, right? The shade.
Oh yeah, it's definitely him.
Okay.
Even though outside of being the narrator, he doesn't really play a role, a first-hand role in this issue.
All right.
Yeah. And I wonder, that's an interesting idea that I have no answer for, but I wonder, since the covers are, generally speaking, comic books, the covers are completed far in advance. Of the actual interior art. It's not the interior art and the covers delivered at once, but usually a little while, you know, for solicits and everything. I think I messed up that word twice now. The covers will be finished. I wonder if at some point, because we have the Shade in a very prominent role, and we don't have Dr. Midnight.
Right, I was just going to say that.
Yeah. I wonder if there was a little bit of a story change, or how that worked.
Right. But like if they wanted to just have four of his buddies instead of... Right, because Dr. Midnight is not there. I actually had to Google who these guys were. I had to, like, read, this is the Flash, and that's our man. What's his name? Our Man, and then Green Lantern, and Dr. Midnight, right?
Yes.
And Dr. Midnight doesn't smile or something, I don't know.
he's very serious.
I see. Okay, so the cover, this is obviously Ted, right? The one with the I want to say headgear, but
like the fin on
his
head.
What is that? Yeah. I can understand why Jack has his reservations about, you know, adopting his dad's costume, because this makes him look like a rooster. So I can't imagine Jack forgiving himself in this costume.
Yeah, definitely doesn't seem like something Jack would wear.
Yeah. Yeah. So Ted and the Shade, and in the background we have the Flash is wearing this weird Robin Hood cap. What is it?
Oh yeah, that the Flash is his original helmet was what was that? It was like a metal almost. Would it be like a World War One hat?
Oh, okay.
In a way, like the metal one. I forget what it's supposed to be from, but it had on the I guess even the modern Flash wears the kind of like wings.
Mm-hmm.
So that was his size. Yeah,
that was
his original headpiece. I mean, these were like original Golden Age characters: the Green Lantern, Starman, Hourman, Flash, and almost all of these. Yeah, all of them have had more modern age updates, or kind of legacy characters.
All right.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm looking at the Flash's current uniform, and there are wings on it. There are wings on his helmet. I see. But it's a lot more subtle in the modern versions.
Yeah, it doesn't have that silver hat is kind of, it's so goofball, yeah. And yet it's also one of the reasons I like comics. Yeah, I can't really explain it, but it's like, well, yeah, of course, it's a silver, he's wearing jeans and a really tight red shirt with a lightning bolt on it, and a what basically looks like a hubcap with wings, but it's great.
Alright, Flash. Okay, so beside him, we have Hourman.
Hourman.
It's the very first time I've heard of Hourman. I've actually, like, being a complete noob at comics, I've actually heard of The Flash and Green Lantern, but I've never heard of Hourman. I'm sorry.
Oh, Hourman is, you know, he's great, and again, like, I don't think I've ever really read any of his, like, original appearances. Most of the stuff I've read have been things that he was included in either in the 80s and after, but I mean, I think his, the look of his costume is great. The yellow and the black and the tights, and they do so much with him, with the idea that, you know, that the pill he takes gives him basically super athlete powers, like strength and durability and yada yada, but only for an hour.
Right.
And, you know, there's some modern tales where it just kind of deals with the fact of, you know, in some ways, this character is addicted to his superpowers.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
I can see that. Right, right. Interesting how they use this as a device to tackle, you know, a thing, a social commentary type of thing.
Oh yeah, we'll get into some of that too. It'll be fun.
Okay. Green Lantern.
Yeah, he's this is even though he had a Green Lantern, he's a very different character from the modern Green Lanterns, who are essentially space cops.
Oh, okay.
And, I mean, depending on which version of Alan Scott you're reading, it's somewhere between mystic and kind of self-generated, but it's the kind of, you know, it's all based on his willpower. Again, another character that I've only read modern retellings of his origins. Which that's pretty much true for all the JSA stuff for the most part. Interesting side note, his powers does not affect anything made of wood.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, because this is kind of Golden Age stuff where they had a power, but all those powers had essentially some kind of weakness.
Makes sense. Makes sense. You don't want a near perfect character. Yeah. All right. So shall we move on?
Sure. I just want to say one more thing about the cover, which this one kind of reminds me of the older, more the earlier covers, where it's a kind of the Art Deco lines of it, and I really like it.
Right.
Moving on.
Very opal. Very opal.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Moving on. It took a while for me to realize what the first panel was. I assume it's like the mayor of Opal or something. I don't know, because you know, we have this like old guy who's been hung from a flagpole.
Yeah.
You know, with the United States of America flag behind him. So it looks like an important building that's behind, like, you know, rising up behind him, so it must have been someone important.
Yeah, is how it looks. It's hard to say who it is, but it's, you know, it's an image that, while unexplained, feels very iconic.
Right. It's one of those like establishing shots that give the Shade's narrative a certain dimension, because you know, right beside this panel is, I guess it's the Shade writing a diary entry.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it shows very clearly that he is, what do you call these people again? Scribes? Like, you know, people who record history.
Yeah. Yeah, scribes.
Yeah.
So, like that, yes. He's got his little pot of ink in the quill.
Yeah. So, okay, what is it? Let's go on.
And yeah, because, you know, that's just kind of, this and the next couple pages all serve the same purpose of just catching us up on who the ragdoll is, what he was, what he is now, and kind of, you know, making him out to be a believable threat.
Right. Mm.
And I think it accomplishes those goals really, really well. That he might not be physically a match anymore, but he's doubled up on scary-tude.
Right. Yeah. Scary-tude. Nice one.
Thank you.
I think it's very reflective of real life as well in this sense, because, you know, now America is having, what do you call it, the presidential campaign, right?
Yeah.
It's, you really see how eloquence can win you supporters, even though, you know, not everything you say is correct in the, I'm just, you know, talking about the main scheme of things, and it just doesn't make sense sometimes, Trump. people that I think it's not too far-fetched for someone like Ragdoll to have his supporters and to have them work for him like this. I mean, not just presidential campaigns, but when you read the news and you find out how people join terrorist organizations, you know, there's this they did a feature on the moms of Jihadist John, I think, and how he was recruited to I can't remember if it was him, but we're talking about all these like educated young men who live in Europe, and they did a feature on their moms and how they've come together to support people whose sons are being tempted and enraptured by the teachings of the extremists. So it's real. It's very real, and it's very scary. And I think comic books are a pretty interesting vehicle to communicate this to teenagers. I mean, 20 years ago. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, to me, the best descriptive paragraph of how this was accomplished was, it's on the page 2, the ragdoll began talking, speaking, offering the lost and the lonely a leader, in a direction to take their empty lives, and those lonely people listened.
Right, yeah.
So something, you know, this is not, it's not something that was reliant on superpowers or on mind control or anything like that. This was just a charismatic person taking people who felt left out.
Right.
And giving them a way in to something.
Right. Yeah. So.
And it's, you know, and the iconography, like the ragdoll shirts, tattoos. I kept on meaning to look up whether or not, because I keep on thinking of Charlie Manson and the swastika on the forehead, but I'm not sure. You know, I wasn't alive, so I'm not sure if that was something all his followers were expected to do, or if just something he did. So here I am being ignorant on my own radio show. No, but it definitely, every time I see it, that's what was brought to mind. So one way or the other, yeah, they're using them, and then we see like the burning of the churches, which, being an American last year, definitely. Rings true, because there was so much violence and of people invading black churches based on their believed superiority, which it's just haunting imagery.
Yeah, I don't. I wonder if 20 years ago, when this was drawn and written, whether there were already like precedents of people burning churches, and I mean in America, but if it's a lot of like foreshadowing. I don't know. It's very it just. Well, I think it is very. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, I don't. I can't remember if that was common in the mid 90s, but I mean that burning churches and those that type of violence, especially along racial lines, has been, you know, a dirty stain that's gone throughout American history. So, you know, even if it's not necessarily, you know, it rings familiar because it keeps coming back, that type of violence.
Right. So I would just like to say kudos to the creators of Starman, who I think it takes a lot of guts to breach topics like that in you know, comic books, in things that are targeted to you know, the masses, and especially to young people.
Yes.
And to, well, I guess, end it off with a positive, hopeful ending. Spoilers. So a lot of respect for, I mean, and this was 20 years ago, so.
Yes.
Society wasn't that, I would expect, even in Western society, it wasn't that open, you know, 20 years ago. I mean, a lot of things have changed since then.
Yeah. And
Starman has been able to, like, you know, remember that time when we were talking about how the girl who was gay?
Yeah.
The one who got sucked into the poster? So how they could touch on that. And this was 20 years ago when it wasn't so, you know, open. And this as well. Yes.
And nowadays it is kind of just accepted that comic books, the main readers of comic books are closer to my age than kids' age. But I think in the 90s it was, you know, the accepted truth, whether or not it was the actual truth, was that most comics were still for children. You know, and like I said, that's what was believed. Whether or not that was actually the truth is that, you know, well, if it's a comic book, any comic book, no matter what it is, you should just be able to give it to like an 8-year-old with no problem. And, you know, and looking at this issue as a whole, I think, you know, I don't think there's any reason you couldn't give this to an 8-year-old. I mean, I don't think they'd get it necessarily, but they could read this and kind of feel they're reading something bigger. And if it stuck with them, the more they read it, you know, as they grew older, they would probably get more out of it.
Right, right, yeah. Agreed. All right, shall we move on to the double page spread? Was this a double page spread?
The double page spread here. I think it's a great timing because we've been talking about the creators, and here we have the creators. Writer James Robinson, colorist Gregory Wright, letterer Gaspar, assistant editor Chuck Kim, editor Archie Goodwin, and for this issue we have a guest penciler inker, Matt Smith.
Matt Smith, I see. Yes. I don't notice these things. I'm so glad you're here. Yes. Okay.
Now, can we take a moment to just talk about Matt Smith?
Okay.
Because, you know, it's kind of the same old crew from last issue. Looks like John Workman is going for Gaspar. What I really like about, I really like the art in this issue, and I don't know why.
Oh, okay.
Well, because it's very, at times, it almost feels very static, and very blocky. But at the same time, I think it really fits this story. It has a nice balance to it, even though, like, I don't know. I feel kind of like a schmuck saying I'm not overall impressed with it, because it is by far better than anything I could do, and there's incredible talent here. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's a great fit for this issue.
Mm-mm-mm. I can't say anything because I don't notice things like that. But I like the way it's, I don't know if this is right because I don't read a lot of comic books, but it feels very traditional.
Yes.
It feels very, like, it's very block. Did you use this word blocky? It's very, the panels, they aren't as dynamic as the previous ones. It's like rows and rows. Do I make sense?
No, it does. It does. Yeah, which gives it that kind of, here we are at a times past, and there is kind of an aping, an homaging of the more traditional comic book layouts.
Okay, and I'm looking at the page where they are, you know, the blocks, the nine panel
grid.
Yeah, nine panel grids. Yes, I'm looking at that right now, and there's a lot of text.
Yes.
What do you think? Do you think it was fun? I liked it because I like dialogue a lot, and there are five people. And to be able to handle that, I think it's amazing that they managed to give us a very clear depiction of who was talking and when.
And
even though there was a lot of text, you don't get confused at all.
And the pages, even though like you said, there's a lot of text on these pages, but it never exactly feels crowded. There's a great balance to it between the figures. It's always very clear who's talking. You know, for like I said, I don't exactly feel overly impressed with the actual figure drawings. The storytelling of it is fantastic.
Yeah, I like the whole, when you have that first page where, you know, there's the title, 13 years ago, Five Friends, a Tale of Time Spot, and you get that one big establishing shot. Yeah. And then after that you have the grid, the nine panel grids on two pages.
Yes.
And you just can feel the pace of the scene. We have to do this. This operation is underway. Da, 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 da.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But it's one of those scenes where I as a complete greenhorn to DC Comics, I can't keep up with who's who. I know who's. I know who is talking because of, you know, it's pictures and speech bubbles, but
yeah.
I don't know, like, Jay is the Flash. I don't know their abilities, you know, so I could only, like, just wait for the next few pages. It was very clear after that, the way, we'll go on to that, but it was very clear because of the way the characters were presented and, you know, the Shades narration and stuff like that. Okay. Yes.
And then we have, this, in a way, from, I think, the bottom of that first nine panel grid page, where, like, you know, the amount of times I fought him, not once did I ever feel in danger, where he starts going that, and to where they talk about the laughing much. I wonder how much of that, you know, I mean, it feels like it's also a commentary on the direction of comics in the 90s. Because 90s was also a time where things started getting grittier and grimmer and darker and more violent. And there's a few comics that kind of talk about this or in response to this. And, you know, I think this issue does that at the same time. Like, you know, okay. the when did all the lunatics become psychopaths? And that was something that was very real in the comics world of it's not just, I'm kind of a wacky villain who's going to do some wacky stuff and then kind of villainous, but also not be just dripping evil to, hey, you know what I'm going to do? A wacky crime and kill a baby. Yay! So, yeah, having the older superheroes talk about that in a way that doesn't sound preachy, it feels natural, is very nice for me.
I see. Interesting. I like hearing about things like that. Okay.
And then they all set out. And I love that pose of them just on top of the hill, the mountain, the house.
Congregation.
Yeah.
It's very symbolic. What do they say? Wait, is that? Oh right, they kind of like distribute the roles before that. I like the way they fly off though.
Yes. With the heroes.
Not all of them fly.
Because Dr. Midnight and Hourman just kind of, I guess, run to their fastest. And Flash, we get the speed lines to show he's moving really fast. Mm-hmm. Our two flyers with their sources of power. Mm-hmm. So it's really well done.
Yeah. I like the next page.
Oh, man.
A lot.
Yeah.
The next page is a close-up of all of them in their respective zones. Right? The Green Lantern. And the lines that they are given. Green Lantern's I can, and Our Man's I will, the Flash's I dare, Dr. Midnight's I shall, and Starman's I must. And you have the Shade saying, like, doing the narration and he's right there at the end, and it reminds you that, oh, okay, this is still a flashback.
And there's something about those grids and the sayings that, like, you know, they, it feels like it should, it could have come off as, you know, cheesy. And yet, like this is just one of those pages that I read, and the more I read it, and every time I get to it, it does kind of send like chills. A little bit. It just feels like a very powerful, heroic moment.
Yeah. I love the text because of the resolve behind
yes.
it. If you didn't have the text, you wouldn't... It would just be, you know, them posing, but... the text was a really nice touch. I get what you mean when you say it sends chills, because it's very... You know, anyone who's watched any, who's found any superhero thing or whatever medium it was in, like an anime or comics or manga or, you know, even cartoons, anyone who has had this sort of moment resonate with them would like this scene.
Yeah.
You know, that moment where the superheroes are going to like go out and do their thing and they are saving the day.
Yeah, you can almost feel the score swelling.
Yes.
And I also just like, I mean, I almost don't even feel we need to have the conversation because I feel it's like an endless conversation. it's so out there of what each and every one of these little phrases, I can, I will, I dare, I shall, I must, like... Mm. You know, why is it that each character's phrase is slightly different? And it feels very important in that it's giving just those two words or which action they're choosing is, you know, defining their character in some way. But it's also one of those conversations because there's just slight changes. I feel if we open that up, that could be like a half hour conversation alone.
Right. But unfortunately, we still have quite a
few
pages to go.
Through.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, even though we were talking about how this is just like, you know, oh, it's a flashback, but it's interesting in a way. It's a very grown up. It's a very grown up issue, I think, because of the issues that it tackles.
And I might be spoiling things. This issue is one of my favorite issues of this comic.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
like, there's something about it. Maybe it's the fact that it's kind of giving the oft ill-used Golden Age heroes a moment to shine and just be awesome in modern comics. But, oh man, it really is one of my favorites.
Yay. Yeah. Okay, so we move on, right, to when they get into the thick of things?
Yes, with, what is it?
Midnight?
Yes, Dr. Midnight is going after the twins who have been kidnapped.
Right.
We're not the twins.
Yeah, the babies, right?
Yeah. The
baby, 2-year-olds. Mm. Wow. I mean, who, honestly, what is this thing with this outrage that's sparked when we hear about children getting murdered, you know, the defenseless getting hurt on purpose. There's this thing, and it's real. Things like this, I keep saying this throughout this issue, but it's real. You know, like that guy who broke into a hospice in Japan. And killed people hooked up to machines. And guys, this is surreal. You know, people do kidnap babies and kill them. So.
Yeah.
Dr. Midnight, though, he comes in and saves the babies. Yay!
And what's interesting about this, that, you know, until, like, I slow down and read it one issue at a time and really have to think about why do I like this, there's another famous comic, you know, Batman Dark Knight Returns. And we have a very similar scene where Batman has to take on a group of thugs who have kidnapped a baby. And you're reading this, it doesn't look similar. They're certainly not any copying of art styles, but just the way it's done and the way it ends up with the one person with the gun on the baby. We have a in the Batman comic, Batman basically resorts to gunfire. Kind of was that really Batman-esque? But here we have Dr. Midnight still controlling the situation. And in a non-lethal way, taking out the kidnappers. So it's just another thing of, it's also interesting when you kind of look in the world of comic books, sorry if I'm just rambling too much, but since that Dark Knight Returns was a comic from the 80s, probably, I think, about 10 years before the current comic we're reading came out, but Dark Knight Returns is said to be one of the comics that started the process of making comics grim and gritty. So I kind of like that there was a scene in that, but still remains hopeful, and just kind of has that argument, the saving of innocence, the sweetest feeling.
And then that's what Dr. Midnight did for this mission.
Yes.
And we have Ted and the Green Lantern and the Flash.
Yes.
Right?
Ted,
I got it.
Alan and Jay. And we also get your favorite character.
Yes, I don't know what he's doing, though. It's like he's taking medicine or something.
Yeah, like, I'm wondering, is he like making absinthe or something?
Oh,
because I've never had absinthe, but it looks like, you know, he's got the spoon and the green liquid, and absinthe feels, you know, like a shade drink.
Ah. Well, creators, if you're listening to us,
Matt Smith, give us a heads up. But I also like that it's kind of the shade being You know, like the, oh, yeah, so how did they find all this stuff out? Well, I kind of told them.
Right. I see. I did not figure that out via the text.
Really?
I see. Yeah. He's so cryptic, I honestly can't tell sometimes, but I wrote earlier that, where he says, I wrote earlier that I had been away from Opal at that time, but that didn't stop me from doing a little digging before I left.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. So, it also tells you that the Shade, he wants Opal to be safe.
Yes.
Mm. Okay.
And that
he's
even
like protector. The protector in the Shade.
Yeah.
In the shadows. Ah, I see. Okay. Nice.
But before the that bit of information is resolved, we flash to Rex Tyler on the bridge.
Our man.
Yeah.
Right. So he has to tackle a mob that is, they are going to cross a bridge to get to the, was it like the place that, where are they going?
It's basically what, an old folks home? Kind of like what you were saying.
Oh, okay.
The retirement community for veterans and such.
Right. Grail, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So in a way, this is almost, you mentioned the attack in Japan. This is almost a crowd of people going to do just that same thing. And one of the few things between them and the community would be our man, who has 1 hour to take out a huge crowd of people.
Right. And the way it's drawn, Brent, the way it's drawn, and the time, the what do you call that, shot clock.
Yeah,
that's nice. The 12 minutes. And 27. Oh, it's actually more of a stopwatch because it's counting up. But it's 12 minutes. And then you have panel where the 12 minutes panel.
Yes.
It reminds me of one of those like art pieces where in hell, where like was it Inferno or something? Where, you know, they have all these like stacked bodies and so that reminds me of that. I like the whole, I like how it's drawn in a narrow vertical panel. Yeah, that's very nice.
Yeah. The only thing missing is, you know, when this scene was described in the earlier issues, I believe it was Ted Knight even saying that, you know, Rex was a god that night. And that always is just one of those things that, it stays with me.
The chills.
Oh yeah, this like the Hourman scene here is definitely one of those things that, you know, it's the sweat afterwards, the smile oh man. Let's move on. It's too good.
Okay. So we finish with Our Man and we go on to The Flash, Green Lantern, and Starman, who are inside a building. I can't remember what building. The it's like the where Ragdoll is, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So there are a lot of Ragdoll's people there as well. They kind of have to fight them. And these people, I don't know why. I wonder how they got their hands on weapons, but there's like gunfire and stuff.
Well, you know, I mean, hate to keep turning this show towards the political, but guns aren't exactly that hard to get a hold of in the land of the free.
I see. Yeah. Okay. I see. Yes. I've before 2015, 2016, it just seemed so unimaginable that that, you know, guns would be such an issue, because to me it was always like, just don't use them, just ban them. But
well, I got to be honest. I want everyone to be able to enjoy the show and love comics. I'm a little worried about opening up on my exact feelings on gun control, and because of isolating fans. But I will kind of say, yeah, I certainly do feel stronger gun control would not be a bad thing.
I see. Yeah. Well, coming from someone who has no concept of what it means to be free to own guns, that's why it's just such a non-issue for me. The idea of there being a world where a country that guns are so accessible. Mm. It's something that I have had to educate myself about. Yeah, so it's not so bad to not have guns. if any of you are wondering, it's really not so bad. We are. I'm from a very small but very affluent country, and we don't have guns.
And it's not so bad.
It's not so bad. Yeah. And we just won our first Olympic gold medal. In the Summer Olympics. We had a Paralympic gold medal before. So just saying. totally unrelated. Just wanted to plug that. All right. So we have these three guys who are inside the Ragdoll's lair, and they are fighting off a mob in their own special way, I guess, because you see like and flash.
We get that splash page of them all fighting, and then the next page is the three panels of them kind of doing their thing in their own special way, and it looks great.
Yeah, I've never seen the Flash actually do something. So this is the first time I'm seeing his powers depicted. And
running with the trail.
Yeah, sorry, I'm not talking. Sorry, not Flash. The Green Lantern, the net.
Yeah, the net. Making the constructs.
They're called constructs.
Well, energy constructs, or yeah.
I see. Okay, so that's what he can do. Yeah. He like creates. But not it doesn't work on wood.
Doesn't work on wood.
Okay. And then we have Ted at the bottom panel. He is flying and using his rod to fry people. I don't know. Yeah. So I guess they fight through this crowd and finally get to Ragdoll, right?
Yeah. Now, right when we turn the page to the where Ragdoll is tied up, I like that there's the color palette change where everything seems dimmer and darker. That's all I got.
there's a little panel at the top left with. I really like this panel because the three heroes, they are just a silhouette. Mm. It's just their silhouette, and Ragdoll, he is sitting in a chair, he's bound.
Yeah.
He's the only one in relative color. You know, it's blue.
Yeah.
That's a pretty powerful image because I can't help but think that, okay, this is a scene not only from our eyes, but through, we are looking at it from the Shade's point of view, maybe. Mm. And, you know, this is how it's a little bit mysterious, and it must have, I don't know, there's this like weird significance that I'm trying to put to it. It's very one of those defining moments. And then we have that, and then in the middle of this page there's this like bam, this bam, and then we see the eyes of Ragdoll, and he looks like this super villain with the shadows on his face, and he tells them that not one, all of you will lament tonight. And then he goes on to threaten them, and he knows a frightening amount of information about their private lives. Yeah, so that's very creepy.
Now, right now, just right now, as we're talking, there's something about the panels and the way it's laid out and the character of Ragdoll that I'm very much reminded of Heath Ledger's take on the Joker.
You and, too?
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Yeah,
like that's all I can think is how much. Yeah, I wonder if there was any inspiration taken. I mean, that's pretty a big leap, but it just feels very much.
Yeah. Looking at it right now.
But then we get Ragdoll, after those threatening and letting him know he'd come for what's important to them, he runs away, tries to escape. We don't actually see the moment of confusion, as it's called. We have a energy effect from the outside, and then we've got on the last page, we've got a dead Ragdoll.
All right.
And kind of crestfallen heroes.
Yeah. But turning back to the second last page, I think there's this part where Shade is writing on his paper, and then they show the scene where Ragdoll kind of leaps away from the three heroes. That it took a while for me to remember that Ted was the one that finished him off, the Ragdoll. And that helped me interpret this like shining circle of light around the cosmic rod. That must have been the zap that killed Ragdoll. And the thing is, why would that have, because the panel below that is like the factory, the place that Ragdoll was in, it kind of like exploded. Would that, why would the cosmic rod actually have that effect? I have no idea.
Well, I think what they're going for is, in that issue where Ted said he's the one he did it, he also says, they all acted at the same time. That's supposed to be like a visualization of both he and Alan Scott, the Green Lantern, just letting loose, which is why we have the yellow energy, the green energy. And I guess one thing to keep in mind is, definitely Ted claimed credit makes it sound like a boastful thing where, he actually felt more regretful from it. But I wonder if Alan Scott were to speak about it, would he say he was the one who went too far?
Right. Yeah. And then we have the last page where Shade, he says it very explicitly that the Ragdoll is dead, and then he goes on to say that the body of the Ragdoll was stolen the following afternoon from the morgue.
Yeah.
That was creepy. That
it
was like,
really is. And, it's just that creepy, but then we also have the moment of the way the heroes are all looking down, where in a way this comic has kind of been the like a subplot was the idea of, we had the Golden Age characters and their villains being turned more villainous, but at the end of the comic the day is saved by the heroes resorting to actual killing. So I don't know, like it's a bittersweet ending. To me, at least.
Yeah. But heroes killing, I don't know. Is that bad of a thing? I don't know.
Go ahead.
No, it's just one of those, like, why does a country have to have an army? And then, because you have to defend your people, and then you have to kill people to defend your people. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of those bits is part of the fancifulness of superheroics is people who do their best to rise above what is normal.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and what is normal is if you're in this situation and someone says like, "Hey, when I get out, I'm gonna, you know, do my best to make your life hell," is maybe not responding in kind, but doing whatever you can to protect. And that's the normal thing, but there's supposed to be something about heroics. That means you don't have to go that far. You don't have to be as bad as the villains or as strong as the villains. But then again, this also kind of ties in the idea of, well, in earlier comics, in the Golden Age comics, it would have been like, "I'm going to rob a bank, ha 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 ha." Not like, "I'm going to find out where your children are and murder them." Like, that's, like, I don't think, you know, too, well, at the very beginning of the Golden Age, Batman was a brutal SOB. I mean, that's pretty true. But, you know, they kind of did get away from the dark crime stories where everyone was killing everyone to a bit more of the fun.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. And the end.
Yeah. So what'd you think of this issue?
It was very real. I keep saying that. It's like the keyword for this issue. It just made me connect fiction with society a lot. I think that maybe it's because of the way I did the what happened in September 1985, but you know, fiction and how it blends with real life. I appreciate that though. That fiction draws so much from real life, and even comic books. It's not just they try to touch on these topics, and I think it's really cool. Well, I think it's a very adult issue.
I think so too. There's layers. There's layers.
I know. I can't help but thinking, you know, we're talking about how you can give this book to an 8-year-old and have them read it. I don't know whether they would enjoy it. Maybe they would with all the fighting and heroics. Yeah. But, you know, they would probably find the parts where I don't know. Would they find it scary? Would they find it creepy? Would an 8-year-old really understand? No, they wouldn't. They wouldn't understand how scary it is exactly.
Yeah, like I think a younger child would see it kind of the adventure story of it. Crime is going off and people are doing bad things and there's an evil guy who's in charge of it, and then this one superhero, he like totally calls his other superhero buddies and they go out and they like fight the bad guys and they punch him in the face, and then like at the end, like the bad guy, you know, he says, I'm gonna come after you, but then he like tries to escape or do something, and then the heroes they shoot him and he dies. And it was really cool. But I think like that kind of the talking about like how dangerous it is to have that persuasive yet evil figure leading a cult. Like, I think most of that would be lost.
You just did like 8-year-old brain synopsis.
Oh yeah, totally. That could have been the synopsis from the 8-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of the beautiful things about this issue, is like, if you read it as an adult and if you read it as a kid, it's going to be completely different. I'm going to apply it very differently.
Well, yes! In a way, I'll bring up Dark Knight Returns again. I remember I got that when I was probably too young to actually get that comic. You know, I was definitely in early elementary school, and I knew it was this exciting, like different from any other Batman comic I've ever seen, but for years, every time I read it, I would get something new out of it, because I was getting older and I was able to understand more of what the conversation was about. And it, you know, since I'd been reading it for so long, sometimes it actually took me to like figure out, like, wait a minute, this isn't what I thought it was. This is something else, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. That's right. That's the same for me with several novels that I read in my childhood, like Roald Dahl and stuff like that. Yeah. Okay.
Well,
so
Olivia,
Simon,
where can they find you on the internet?
They can find me on Twitter mostly, and YouTube, and Instagram, and Facebook at the username Quek Channel, Q-U-E-K Channel. I'm going to be posting on YouTube soon, I hope.
Huzzah!
Yay! But I'm going to go more into music, I think, from now on. So stay tuned. Stay tuned.
Exciting.
Yes. How about you, Brent?
Well, I'm not as easy to find because I have way too many different names. On Twitter, I'm at Dead Troubadour. My main writing website is Dead Lee Troubadour. But you know what? You can always go to Facebook and just like the Brent Thomas author page. Or if you just want to like just stuff for the show, there's a Comics League International page. And don't forget, if you're signed up to like this or signed up to subscribe to this through iTunes, you can leave a rating and a review there. That would be nice. I could use some more of them. Yeah.
Yes.
That's all I got.
Yes. I hope that you guys will enjoy this 21-year-old comic with us. 22-year-old comic with us, yeah. Because we have 19 more issues? Or more?
Of Starman?
Yeah.
This is number 11. Yeah. And Starman itself has 80/81 issues, and there's extra tie-ins and stuff, so we've still got a good anywhere from like 90 to 100 issues left, depending on what we want to add in.
Yeah, and if we do this weekly, we're going to do this for like a year.
Yes!
And over a year. Wow!
You better not move anytime soon. We got a lot of Starman left.
Yeah, alright.
Don't get discouraged. We can do it. We have the power.
We have the power of the cosmic rod and the power of suns. That's what they said in this issue.
Zap, zap, zap.
Zap, zap, and we are out.
Bye.
There's a star man waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a star man waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it, cause he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children lose it, let the children use it, let all the children boogie.